This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I detect in Reform a bit of an arrogance, to be honest. I think they overestimate the size of the share of the population that actually agrees with them, and their own propaganda is perhaps going to their heads. And I certainly think if the election was rerun tomorrow, they probably would not do as well. And we'll see what the people of Kent think in 2 years or 4 years' time when there are further local elections.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, anti-immigration and anti-government protesters gathered in Dover, roadworks in Medway were driving residents around the bend, and KCC decided not to close down the county's tips after all. I'm Simon Finlay, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Dan Essen, who covers the borough and districts.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway.
Hello.
And senior news editor Nikki White, who'll be talking about what's happening in Westminster.
Hello.
And this week's guest is the KCC opposition leader, Anthony Hook, who represents Faversham for the Lib Dems. Right, kicking off, Dan, what's caught your eye this week?
Well, when a protest happens, I can scarcely keep away from it. So yet again, this weekend, there was a demonstration in Dover taking in all the sights and sounds.
Immigration, I assume.
Of course, yeah. Mm. So it's part of this spate of protests, or calling themselves the Great British National Protest, formerly the Great British National Strike. There's been a few of them over previous months in towns up and down the country. They're organised by some former soldier called Richard Donaldson. Essentially, it's your standard fare fusing primarily, you know, anti-immigration politics with general dislike of the government and Keir Starmer personally, if any of the more profane chants I heard there were to be taken seriously.
So what was the turnout like, and what was the general feeling there?
Well, it's important to bear in mind, so prior to this gathering, Mrs. Donaldson's social media page for it breathlessly declared that they expected millions of people to attend. Hard to tell whether that's, you know, just delusion or attention seeking. But by my reckoning, there are about 300 people there total, so they pretty much set themselves up for disappointment. But for one of these things in Dover, that's not an atrocious turnout, given I've been to ones of these before, which have had, you know, literal handfuls of people.
I went to one that was about 13 people turned up. They thought it was going to be thousands. So
yeah, it's quite embarrassing for everyone involved. So it wasn't quite that terrible. Yeah, there were lots of rumours, you know, swirling around the protests that that big names on the scene like Tommy Robinson might turn up. Obviously, that didn't materialise. There were, however, a couple of Reform county councillors for Dover there. I went and spoke to them. Yeah, they told me they were there to show solidarity with the public who are vexed by immigration, and with local Reform members, many of whom were present, which is certainly true. But I think they might have thought twice pretty quickly about their attendance, because my there were clearly members of very extreme parties there. I spoke to at least one member of Patriotic Alternative, which are pretty much a white supremacist party. And my conversation with these two Reform councillors was interrupted by an elderly couple from Leeds who said some, shall we say, very colourful things about people of other races and religions, which was very uncomfortable for everyone involved.
Thanks, Dan. Robert, what's been happening in Medway?
Well, roadworks are always an annoyance, but for one village on the Hoo Peninsula, residents have successfully managed to get a reprieve on 2 weeks of planned roadworks for later this month, because they raised the alarm on a diversion route that they called unworkable. SGN had planned to close a section of the B2000 entirely just outside of Cliff Woods on the side of the village towards Strood, and they proposed a diversion which went down to Wainscott, out to High Halstow, up to Cooling, across to Cliff, and then down to Cliff Woods.
And what's the problem with this diversion?
Well, villagers accept that the works need to be done at some point, but the big issue they raise is that there is a large amount of heavy goods vehicle traffic which will need to use this diversion. Now, I've driven that route, and there are a number of tight S-bends, and a good portion of it is single lane. I got stuck several times, even just with regular-sized cars, so the locals say this is just going to cause mayhem and cause problems for getting around and emergency vehicles.
Have they got a reprieve?
Yes. After the details became known to locals, they immediately started contacting council, asking how the route had been approved and raising their concerns, saying it seemed like someone who didn't know the actual situation of the area had made the route just by looking at Google Maps. Now the permission for the works, which was due to start on the 28th, has been revoked, and the route is being looked at with the works delayed until that's done.
Okay, thanks, Rob.
Simon, what's been going on at County Hall?
There was a moment that almost passed without much notice at the Environment and Transport Committee at KCC the other day when a cabinet member for that portfolio, the environment portfolio, announced that none of the county's tips are under threat of closure for at least 5 years. If anyone casts their minds back a couple of years, this was very much the hottest topic in town. The then ruling Conservative administration proposed that it was going to shut four of six tips in Kent in order to save about £1 million a year. And it was just one of the places the KCC were looking at to try and shave a bit here and shave a bit there to try and balance the books or face effective bankruptcy. But the plans were eventually shelved because of the not least because of the furious backlash. And our special guest today, Anthony Hook, led a campaign which collected 3,000 signatures in a few days on this. And there were protests outside County Hall, and eventually the whole process dragged on and on for months.
So how did it all end up?
Well, the Tories caved in and shelved the plans. They didn't quite get rid of them initially, but eventually they did get rid of them altogether. And not least when there was a rebellion on the backbenches. The backbenches were telling me that members were going to lose their seats in 2025 if the leadership didn't change its mind.
Is this why the Conservatives lost so heavily in May?
No, I don't think so. I think it was a whole combination of things, but it certainly didn't help. But Reform UK, who are now in charge of County Hall, will remember how toxic these things can become and how quickly they can become toxic. And the whole narrative of the need to find savings for the greater good was completely washed away by a wave of public anger. So Reform will have to be careful not to fall into any similar bear trap in the future on pledging to keep all the tips open. It was more of a continuity thing to extend the contracts of the companies that run them, because no one really knows what's happening because of local government reorganisation. So it was welcomed broadly by everybody, but it was no grand gesture. Nikki, what's happening with our MPs?
Well, if there's one thing that gets MPs and a lot of people hot under the collar, it's big bosses taking bonuses when their firm isn't delivering. Now, at the end of last week, it emerged that Lawrence Gosden, who's the boss of Southern Water, he received a payout of almost £700,000. And that was linked to the company's performance just weeks before a ban on bonuses for the firm was introduced.
That's a bonus of quite some size, isn't it?
Isn't it? I mean, his base salary alone in the last tax year was just over £500,000. And in addition to that, he also got what was described as a long-term incentive payment. Mr. Gosden also received £111,400 worth of benefits and £75,100 of pension-related benefits, and that was according to a Southern Water report. Now, while the payout is all above board and legal under the regulations that were in place at the time, critics have said it's morally disgraceful and that he's accepted it, as Southern Water has often been criticised for pollution incidents, including the pumping of sewage into the seas off the Kent coast, and that's as well as having dozens of leaks across the network. Now, Southern Water says the expenses will be paid for entirely by shareholders, not customers, but it's left a nasty taste in the mouth for many. Southern Water is now one of six companies banned from paying senior executives traditional bonuses for failing to meet high standards, but those rules only came into effect in June. Now, that did prevent Mr. Gosden from pocketing a further £396,475. That's correct. But the company says his LTIP bonus up to the end of March will be paid in full, as it was agreed before the ban was brought in.
Several MPs campaigned for those changes over bonuses, didn't they? What have they had to say about all this?
Yeah, they're not very happy. And every Labour MP whose constituents are Southern Water customers has this week signed a letter demanding Lawrence Gosden refuse the pay rise, or if he's had it, to pay it back. Now, that letter was coordinated by East Thanet MP Polly Billington, who's been very vocal about water issues. But others who put their names to it include Lauren Edwards, who represents Rochester and Stewart, City-born and Sheppey's Kevin McKenna, Chatham and Aylesford rep Tris Osborne, Gravesham MP Lauren Sullivan, and Folkestone Hythe's Tony Vaughan, Dartford's Jim Dixon, Ashford MP Sojan Joseph, Gillingham Rainham's Nishaba Khan, and Mike Tapp, who represents Dover.
Okay, so what does the letter say then?
It's pretty blunt. They say they're appalled at this enormous incentive payment, which they described as, and I quote, a shameful and blatant attempt by Southern Water executives to circumvent the bonus ban and enrich themselves without any justification beyond pure greed. Now, they go on to say that constituents will be asking themselves why the chief exec of Southern Water would need to be incentivised in this way to care about sorting out issues which are on his watch. But they're urging him to do the right thing, saying in their words, you should decline this disgraceful payment for failure.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Anthony Hook has been in politics one way or another for more than two decades, including a short spell as an MEP, and he's still only in his early 40s. When Reform UK swept into office at Kent County Council with a massive majority in May, the Liberal Democrats emerged as the biggest opposition party with 12 seats. Anthony is now the official leader of the opposition at a time of great change at County Hall. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, Simon.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
How are you finding your new role as opposition leader at County Hall?
It's probably the most important role I've ever had.
Well,
it's
even, my job. Even outside of the European Parliament?
But possibly, I think. I mean, the European Union obviously deals with huge international issues, but I was one MEP out of many hundreds. Whereas at KCC now, my job is to lead efforts to scrutinise and to challenge the administration, to demand better for the public. So in some ways, yeah, it is very important. And the issues facing KCC are huge and urgent at the moment in terms of a budget crisis and also real concerns about the quality of our services, both for old people who need care and for children who need special help with their education. So I'm very motivated. I've got a brilliant team. The election result doubled the size of the Lib Dem group, made us the biggest opposition group. And I've got a really skilled team, lots of professional experience in that team who are really keen. And so I'm very motivated at the moment.
Would you say that you were surprised by the scale of Reform's victory? 57 seats out of 81 is a big old
challenge. I was. I thought they were going to get a smaller number of seats than that. And I thought the council would probably be no overall control. I didn't think any party would have a majority. I think the result gave Reform a win that was wide but shallow. And what I mean by that is wide in the sense that they won 57 seats, and that was across the county in lots of different places. But shallow, they only got 37% of the vote. So almost two times the vote against them and for them. And in Kent County Council's 135-year history, no administration has ever been formed with a vote share as small as that. The Conservatives sometimes got a majority of the vote, or sometimes, like in 2021, they got in the high 40s. More votes against them than for them. But this is quite new. And I detect in Reform a bit of an arrogance, to be honest. I think they overestimate the size of the share of the population that actually agrees with them, and their own propaganda is perhaps going to their heads. And I certainly think if the election was rerun tomorrow, they probably would not do as well. And we'll see what the people of Kent think in 2 years or 4 years' time when there are further local elections.
What's your impression of the new leader at KCC, Lyndon Kemp-Caron?
I think it's pretty disappointing, not just the leader, but the whole administration is pretty thin as to what they're actually doing. And quite a lot of spin and sound bites and clickbait rather than substance. I mean, they cancelled all the meetings in June. Meetings are really important for councillors to represent the views of their residents and to exchange views with the senior officers who run the council day to day. So that has been, I think, a loss that the council's taken as long as it has to really get going. Their Doge thing was, I think, a bit of a damp squib. I mean, they came in with a celebrities and a big song and dance about this money they would find. They haven't found anything. In fact, they made claims that have just been proved to be not true. And the recent scrutiny committee, the committee went through the things Zia Yusuf has tweeted, and none of them were true. None of the Reform councillors in the room were even willing to try and defend them. And then 10th of July, you had the last full council, only the second one that's taken place. And the agenda was ridiculous. I mean, the administration can put as many items on the agenda as they want. The only substantive item they put on was about councillors' own pay. Well, there's much bigger issues facing the people of Kent than that. Opposition groups can put one item on the agenda each. The Greens put an excellent motion on domestic violence. The Liberal Democrats put an excellent motion on blue badge disabled parking permits. So I would say the opposition is far more in touch with what people are actually caring about. And the behaviour of Reform councillors that meeting was extraordinary. They voted down the domestic violence motion, and they put a wrecking amendment in to gut the blue badge motion, which I found really shocking.
In fairness to Reform, actually, I mean, I've watched several of the new committees that got up and running this month, and most people think, including some officers and members of the opposition, that the conduct of the committees has been very good. They've elected a chair in the usual way. The meetings are conducted with politeness and courtesy and giving people a chance to speak, although the agendas, I agree, have been slightly thin. But it's been at the full council meetings when there's the sort of the pack mentality there that tends to be a bit more of the grandstanding going on. Would you not agree with that? That the committees so far have been actually pretty well run.
Yes, the committee meetings have been pretty good, have been very courteous and very professional. And as you say, in a really quite an odd contrast with the full council's meetings, where the reform group have behaved in a kind of a pantomime fashion of giving their leader a standing ovation every time she speaks, not really answering the questions and treating them like political rallies, whereas the committees have been professional. And that's why we should have had them in June. We need more of them, because it's in the committees you get into the detail.
Absolutely.
And if you provide a good service to people, you've got to get into the detail of what is happening, where, when, how is it being funded, and so on.
Yeah. I mean, depending on who you speak to, the shortfall in the budget for next year could be anything between, I don't know, 100 million and 140 million. The numbers are so big, it almost doesn't matter. These are vast, eye-watering sums. I mean, where on earth do you think they'll be able to find that sort of money?
I don't know if it'll be as big as that. We'll have to see it. But in this year's budget, there's been a significant overspend in the tens of millions. Most of the overspend is in adult social care. Although you wonder, is it adult social care is underspending, or were the figures at the budget process last time just made to look smaller than they should have done, and they were always unrealistic? It's very hard to say. And I think the truth of the matter is that in local government, there's not a lot of fat to cut now, because we've had cuts year on year, certainly every 8 years, all the 8 years that I've been a county councillor, and before that as well. So there's been a huge pressure to find efficiencies for a long time. The council's got independent external auditors who are pretty rigorous in finding things that where money could be spent better. I think it's going to be a big problem if we were to have to make cuts of that size. But the unknown factor is what the government settlement will be in the autumn. So the council's funding comes partly from council tax and also partly from central government. And we don't yet know in the autumn statement how much funding the government will make available for local governments. It's really quite an undemocratic system, in my view, that people at a local level elect a local council or a county council. But what the county council can do or not do is entirely dependent on what a different elected body elected at a different time gives it by way of funding.
Do you think that reform can last the course at KCC, given all the pressures?
You mean stay in power for 4 years?
Yeah, well, until the new party comes in.
They've got a big majority. I mean, you need 41 seats for majority. They started with 57. They're down to 56 now. So it would be very surprising if they couldn't last through. Having said that, on the 10th of July, when some of the votes were taken, they were down to 41 in terms of votes being cast. So honest answer is I don't know. You would expect a party with that big majority to easily last the distance, but there is an air of instability and unpredictability about reform.
Another big topic on everyone's minds in local government is local government reorganisation, where every council in Kent will effectively be abolished and replaced by a smaller number of much larger unitary authorities. Where do the Lib Dems stand on that?
Our view is that there may be some advantages to having a single tier rather than two tier. At the moment, people are often very confused about when they've got a local problem, with the bins, is it the district council or the county council? With housing development, is it the district council or the county council? But our main concern is that the process of change needs to be led by the public. And if we are going to change the councils, we need to change into something that has been designed by the public and not imposed from top down. At the moment, it's been a very top down process. The meetings have tended to be in private. There hasn't been much published, but that has changed for the better this week. I mean, Lib Dems have been saying since this was launched in December, we need to put everything out in public as much as possible. And it was our lobbying led to, it was agreement with the last county council, there would be a local government committee that was on ice, sophisticated, they were too sure about doing that. But that the committee is now going to meet next week. And a couple of days ago, the papers for it were published, which are very interesting. It had six options, which have been analysed and scored by KCC officers. And their scoring comes out with what they call option one as the best, which is three unitary councils, east, west and north. That, to my mind, is somewhat problematic. The western configuration, which is Sevenoaks, Tunbridge Wells, Tunbridge and Morley and Maidstone, makes a degree of sense. And I've spoken to people in those areas. They think that is sensible. The northern configuration, which is a, would be a very long sort of sausage-shaped council, Dartford, Gravesham, Medway, Swale, is problematic. Certainly people in eastern Swale look towards the east, more towards Canterbury or Ashford for social and economic and work-related ties. They don't tend to look towards the west, and certainly from Swale to Dartford, there are very few links in that respect. Mm. So option one, it looks like people are aligning behind that. My preference would be for a 1A, where we have some flexibility in eastern Swale, perhaps goes in with Canterbury in East Kent. And there may well be some people in Ashford who, in the western parts of the Ashford district, who feel they're more inclined towards western Kent than eastern Kent. The 12 districts we've got were created in 1972, and my view is that they shouldn't become straitjackets for how we configure the new councils 50 years later.
Anthony, but you know, it's always been said that they don't necessarily have to be within those strict geographical confines in which a borough or district council is in. So if you wanted to shave a little bit off and give it over to one another, or shave enough another bit and give it to something else, you're able to do that. You might be able to put a little bit of Sevenoaks up into that north option one. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And that's what we would like to happen. Mm. And it's sort of ambiguous and depends who speaks, because the white paper uses some phrase like the starting point will be existing boundaries. And if you talk to some officers, they seem, well, if you look at the six options in the paper, they're only thinking so far in those 12 jigsaw pieces and how do you shape those. And I think a very important thing for people to do is to put, let's say option one is selected, we need to then put pressure on for there to be a 1A or a 1B, whereas you say some bits are shaved off their existing district to go in a more suitable place at the end. It will cause a bit more administrative inconvenience because you'll have to then separate the assets and the debts of the districts as well as separating those of the county, but that will be a fairly small bit of work compared to the size of the task anyway. And if we're setting something up that will hopefully last for at least another 50 years, let's do it. It's a small bit of extra work now to get it right for half a century.
Okay. If you look at the national polling, the Tories are in pretty much in free fall. The Labour Party seems to have completely lost the confidence of the country. Can the Liberal Democrats seriously be the party to become an official opposition or potentially a party of government? Presumably, you know, if reform is or isn't the largest party come the next election, but the polls certainly seem to think that.
I think there's a really exciting opportunity for the Lib Dems at the moment. I mean, we tend to be around the same as the Conservatives in support, but as you say, they're in free fall and we're growing. And I think the opportunity for us is this. We're fundamentally a centre party and we want to grow, and we should be looking to attract people who've previously voted Labour and feel disillusioned and offer them something more hopeful. And equally, people who've previously voted Conservative but don't like the kind of lurch to the right of reform and who would actually find, I think, a much better home with us. So I think there's a big opportunity. And I think the polls are incredibly hard to read because tactical voting will be more important than ever. It was very important last year in a kind of, if you either liked the Conservatives or you didn't. And if you didn't like the Conservatives, lots of people were saying, who should I vote for locally to get them out? But I think the tactical voting will be more complicated. And as you look at the poll now with the sort of five main parties, I think you need, one way to consider it is in a lot of constituencies, reform will be contenders, and then the other contender will be who is best placed to beat reform. And I think there'll be a lot of transfer. I think a lot of people who, the Greens are on about 9 or 10%, but I suspect in Lib Dem target seats at the general election, 90% of those people will be very happy to lend their votes to the Lib Dems to help us beat reform. I expect most Labour people will, particularly in the south of England, will be willing to vote for Lib Dems rather than reform. Yeah. And I think Conservatives probably split down the middle. So I think the polls are really hard to read at this point.
That's fair enough. You're talking about polling, but I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we haven't heard an awful lot from Ed Davey of late since the May elections and about what the sort of the national policy platform might be. I mean, clearly, you know, the Lib Dems have always been very strong on policy, and you've always had big thinkers thinking big thoughts and coming up with big ideas. But we haven't heard much lately about what that is likely to be, or are you just keeping your powder dry for the minute?
Ed gave quite an interesting, important speech on the economy about a week ago to the IPPR, where he set up the Lib Dem vision for the economy. I think the economy will be the key battleground for the general election. And he spoke about plans to cut energy bills in half over the next decade. And to be clear, the Lib Dems will be the sort of people who challenge some of the anti-immigration rhetoric and talk about how free trade is really good for business. It's also good for consumers, good for families to bring down the cost of living. And actually, free trade is the way to do that, not Donald Trump-style tariffs. He also talked about the need to support small businesses, startups, self-employed people, and also the importance of education and training, because everyone wants growth in the economy. And if you listen to the Labour government, you think the only way to get growth is to build more houses. But actually, another way to get growth is to really invest in people and to equip people with more training and more skills and to reskill people so that they can be more productive and do different jobs or do their jobs in a different way that actually is more productive. One of the other areas, I know Ed is very passionate about education, and the party recently set out some principles for how we would address SEND, special educational needs and disability, including more special school capacity, early identification and waiting lists. So the party's definitely active. I think one issue is that in the clickbaity era we live in, there are perhaps other parties that at the moment are better tooled up and skilled to do that. And I think the Lib Dems need to think about how we can use modern technology better than perhaps we do to communicate the really good ideas that we have.
You and I spoke a few months ago and you sort of said you were wondering aloud, really, whether this whole sort of volatility within politics in Great Britain is really just the prelude for a massive shift, the sort of shift that comes along every century or so. Do you just like to explain you're thinking behind that is? I'm not saying you were saying it was going to happen, but you were just...
No, I'm very interested in history. And if you sort of look at political history in the long term, every 70 to 100 years, there tends to be a big shake-up of the party system. And you know, one instance that would be after the First World War, the Liberal Party was kind of replaced by Labour, and people who previously voted Liberals split in two directions. And in the late Victorian era, there was a lot of change, and the Liberal Party was formed in 1870-ish through a merger of the Whigs and a Tory faction that supported Robert Peel and another faction called the Radicals. So the political system tends to be in flux and is not set in stone. And I think it's possible we are seeing a bit of a realignment. We might be seeing the replacement of the Conservative Party by a harder right, more populist party in the shape of Reform, who I don't think are Conservatives. I think they're nationalists rather than nationalist populists rather than Conservatives. And then that's an opportunity for us as a Liberal Centre Party to try and attract new support. You know, I think the future of Labour is very unclear as to what Labour stand for. It looks like they might face a challenge on the left, maybe from a Corbynite party, who knows? Yeah. I mean, I don't think such a party is likely to do very well.
But if they take 10% or even 5% of their support, and you take 5 or 10% of their support, so there's not much left, really, is there?
Yeah, but our job will be not just to take 5% of support. I mean, your analysis is right. They will be squeezed in that way. But our job will be to try and create a bigger tent that brings together enough people to win a lot of seats and offer a really good centrist, liberal, democratic, non-populist vision for the country. And I think the Lib Dems of change. I think some people perceive that once upon a time we were a protest party, and that might have been true once, but I don't think that's true now. I mean, certainly none of the people who voted for me and May did it as a protest. They voted because in the local area I was campaigning on issues that people cared about, and all our 72 MPs who were elected last year, I think that'd be pretty, none of them were elected as a protest. No. They were elected because people thought this guy or the man or woman will be a really good champion for my local area. So I think we've got a good direction and quite a serious direction.
Okay. Listen, Anthony, lovely to speak to you as ever. Don't be a stranger to us, and hopefully you'll come back and speak to us once more very shortly.
Thanks very much. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Kent MPs have called for the boss of Southern Water to return a £700,000 performance incentive bonus. Yes, you heard that correctly. Some people are calling for the water companies to be properly brought into line, and for bosses who willfully send raw sewage into our rivers and coastal waters to be charged with criminal offences. Nikki, you're across this story. What's your take on it?
Well, a lot of our MPs are very, very angry, and not just them, a lot of people are as well, and you can see why. Now, as I said earlier, Lawrence Gosden has done nothing legally wrong by taking this payment. It was all due before the new rules came in, banning these bonus payments to senior execs. And some would argue, good luck to him. You're owed it. Take it. But when you're talking about such huge amounts of money, and in this case, it's almost £700,000, as you said, and that's on top of what he already earns, it's really hard for people to understand why this is happening. Now, I'd like to think that if I was in Mr. Gosden's position and earning that kind of cash, I'd do the right thing and not just pay the bonus back, but maybe ring fence it to going towards something, a specific project. I wouldn't want to see it swept back into the general coffers, but maybe look at some of the towns and villages where there's problem after problem with water, and doing something that makes a real positive difference. I mean, until then, you've got lots of people who earn a pittance seeing these big bonuses being paid out, and then they're being told, oh, your water bill is going to be hiked up. Now, the letter to Southern Water from these Labour MPs, that's not the only correspondence that's been sent in the past few days. Maidstone MP Helen Grant, who's a Tory, she's written to South East Water Chief Exec David Hinton. Now, she says she's got deep concerns about water bills rising, which she says in her constituency of Maidstone and Morling, they're going to go up to 77%. Now, she says this is all in the face of history of repeated supply interruptions, burst mains, prolonged outages and poor customer communication. She pointed to one particular incident or several incidents, Five Acre Wood School in Lewes. It's a special educational needs school and it's been forced to close several times just because it doesn't have enough water. Now, she said, you know, there's poor management, poor performance and chronic underinvestment, but this is all while directors are continuing to receive bonuses and it's not good enough. Now, we have an ageing water system, I get that. Repairs are needed and you don't always have the resources to get things done immediately. It needs paying, I get that too. But when you see the pollution being pumped into our waterways, long-running roadworks or even worse, leaks that are going unattended for weeks or even months on end, and then you've got these bosses getting these huge payouts, it's just staggering.
But Dan, the politics of all this, I mean, where do you see this going?
I think, I mean, there have been calls for the privatisation of the water industry to be reversed for pretty much ever since it was privatised. It's extremely popular among the general public.
It's effectively a privatised, but it's a privatised monopoly. There's no competition in most of the areas that are covered by a single so-called water company.
Yeah, like the privatisation of most British public services, there is no sense of competition whatsoever. The competition happens at the level of the state picking winners, essentially, and it's got a sort of bloated regulatory industry with it. There's a term in economics or social science, famously Graeber's Law, the idea anything designed to privatise and deregulate and cut regulation almost universally ends up costing more money and creating more regulators, and that's what the privatisation of water has done. And it's an idea so ludicrous that even Chile, the international laboratory of pointlessly privatising public services for the benefit of, you know, international bankers, has not fully privatised their water system. We are the only country on earth with a completely private sewage water system and with all the infrastructure with it. And I think people in the general public, even people who don't care much about politics or the political economy of infrastructure, have a general sense that, you know, water is a crucial national resource. It should belong to the people of this country through the government of this country. That's a perfectly sensible idea. Problem is, it's the good government will say it's far too expensive, because if they nationalise all these private companies, they either default on all of their debts, which becomes a problem because lots of pension companies and that kind of thing own shares in water, so if you don't pay out there, yeah, what they're meant to, yeah, there are sort of secondary economic consequences, or they just take on the balance, you know, all the debts from the balance sheet of companies like Thames Water, which are very happy to rack up, you know, completely excessive debts.
Often wondered why Southern Water calls itself water, because it's not really a water company, it's a sewage company. Maybe they should just rename it Southern Sewage.
Yeah, I think a lot of people look at the point of privatisation was to allow these companies to invest in a way that the government couldn't do at the time. And I think
that was the theory.
Yes, exactly. And now we're decades on, And the as Nikki said, you know, it's decades of underinvestment. So the entire point of this privatisation doesn't seem to have paid off in any way. People aren't getting a better service, and they will start to the argument for nationalisation will become stronger because whether it's right or wrong, it's a very easy answer and a simple answer that will say this decision to privatise didn't work. Let's go back to what we had before.
Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Dan, Robert and Nikki for their contributions and to our special guest, Anthony Hook. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage, and you can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. So see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.